Eyeing home plate, Phillip fires, and it's fouled back. Now 0-2 after the breaking ball. Missed on top of the bat. Dunkey, right-handed hitting left fielder. It's a righty-righty matchup between him and Phillip. And I mentioned the Dock Spiders have two more games after this. One of them at home, as this one is lined down the left field line. Should be foul, and it does bounce. Foul in the grass in left field, so it remains 0-2. The Rafters also have just two games left. Both of them are on the road. They play two games in Wausau, not too far of a drive from Wisconsin Rapids, so hopefully we'll have some fans out there showing up for the final two games of the year against a very good Wausau team. Pickoff move back to first base, checks on Jalen Gellings. Should be a fun one. Trevor Moik and Tyler Pichetti, the two pitchers scheduled to go those days. Moik tomorrow and Pichetti on Saturday. That closes out the season. 0-2 the count. Pitch coming home. Breaking ball once again fouled back by Kunkey. That was a good pitch from Phillip. Just couldn't generate the swing and a miss. Still 0-2 count. Fifth pitch of the plate appearance coming up. Gellings is over there on first still. 9-2 the lead for the Dock Spiders. They've scored two runs this inning. They scored three last. Pitch coming home once again fouled away by Kunkey. Another long plate appearance for the Dock Spiders, despite accuracy from Phillip. 0-2 the count with two outs. Runner on first. Pitch coming home. This time laced up the middle over towards second. And stepping on the bag himself is Arusevic. It goes four unassisted for the fielder's choice. And that takes care of Jalen Gellings for out number three. The eighth inning sees two more runs come across for the Dock Spiders on three hits. There were no errors, and there was one left on base. We go to the ninth. The Rafters trail by seven. This is Rafters Baseball on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Hey, baseball fans. Are you ready to swing for the fences in your career instead of warming the bench? By joining Skyward's award-winning team, you'll put education technology solutions into the hands of school leaders who serve over 7 million students around the world. Innovation, collaboration, and fun are all a part of the Skyward culture. So what are you waiting for? Step up to the plate and apply today at www.skyward.com/careers.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR, brought to you by 8th Street Auto, Econ Electric Inc., Party Envy, Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep, Comfort Air Heating, Cooling, Fireplaces, McCain, Stevens Point Brewery, Delta Dental, Ho-Chunk Gaming Nakusa, Gamber Johnson, Mid-State Technical College, Skyward, Solaris, Aspirus Health, and the Food and Farm Exploration Center. Listen to Rafters Baseball here on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM WFHR, and streaming on the Civic Media app.
Now, let's get back to exciting Rafters baseball here on WFHR.
New pitcher into the game for the Dock Spiders, so we do not see a save here from Colton Angel as he goes three innings pitched and does not allow a run. He allows three hits, two walks, had two strikeouts and one wild pitch. Faced 13 total batters on 57 pitches before handing it off to Samuel Moses. And Moses coming into this one, a 6'1", 200-pounder out of Cedarburg, Wisconsin. He will take on the Rafters 4, 5, and 6 batters in the top of the ninth. The Dock Spiders lead at 9-2. First pitch, a check swing, and called for a strike on the swing from Gaz. 0-1 the count. Gaz, right-handed hitting first baseman. It will be Gaz, Kobayashi, and Bryant in the ninth. 0-1 count. Swing and a miss for strike number two. 0-2 the count. And Samuel Moses taking over into the game here as Colton Angel had the three-inning hold for the Dock Spiders. Very good performance from him, taking over for Jordan Toohey And two, he also had a great start. 0-2 count, swing and a miss for strike number three. Gaz not able to make contact there, and it brings up Hiroto Kobayashi with the bases empty and one out in the top of the ninth. Kobayashi, the right-handed hitting right fielder. It's a righty-righty matchup between him and Moses. And Moses, looking at his numbers this season for the Dock Spiders, comes into this game with an 8.53 ERA as the first pitch misses for ball number one, a 1-0 count, and a two-way player for Fond du Lac, both a batter and a pitcher. He's hit in three games, but not too many, as the 1-0 count is in there for strike number one, now 1-1. Just 1-for-7 as a batter, but as a pitcher, 6 1/3 innings, and trying to get things rolling along. 1-1 count, a check swing, and that is strike number two as he went around on it. So a 1-2 count, and Kobayashi 0-for-3 in the game. Struck out swinging his last time up, but reached first on a wild pitch. 1-2 count, misses outside, now 2-2. And so the multi-on-base streak for Kobayashi ends today as he will not have a chance to reach base multiple times. 2-2 count, fouled back as it remains 2-2. Well, technically he can reach base multiple times with getting on here because he reached on the wild pitch back in the seventh on the strikeout, but won't go toward his on-base percentage, which means that the on-base streak will end. Well, the on-base streak still could stay alive, but the multi-on-base streak will end. He had reached base multiple times in previous seven games. 2-2 the count now to Kobayashi, and at the very least hoping to salvage the night with a hit here. Breaking ball is popped up, though, in foul territory. Could reach out of play. We'll see if it does, and it barely does. Over the extended hand of the catcher Fitz and toward the first base grandstand. Still a 2-2 count, and Kobayashi fighting to stay alive against Moses. Moses' last two times out, it has not gone his way. He's pitched against the Rafters before. That was back on July 23rd here in Fond du Lac. 2-2 count, breaking ball, misses low and away for ball number three. 3-2 the count. In that game against the Rafters, he went 1 2/3 innings and allowed one run, but that run, the losing run in the game, as it would be a 2-1 Rafters victory. 3-2 the count coming home. It's lined over towards first and just foul. Barely lands past the line, and it remains a 3-2 count here. Peyton Bryant is on deck, and Samuel Moses trying to take care of the inning. He comes from Madison Community College. 6'1", 200-pounder, a freshman, as the 3-2 count is held off on, and it misses low for ball number four. And a great plate appearance from Kobayashi, a 9-pitch walk, as he will step over to first base, and he's on for the first time today. Brings up Peyton Bryant to the plate with a man on first and one away in the top of the ninth. Still 9-2, the lead for the Dock Spiders. Peyton Bryant, right-handed hitting third baseman. Righty-righty matchup. First pitch is low for ball number one. 1-0 the count. Bryant 0-for-3 on the game. Struck out looking his last time up, and before that it was a ground out and a fly out. 1-0 count, and this one outside for ball number two, now a 2-0 count. After Bryant, it's Lachlan Maude, but a double play could end the game with Kobayashi standing on first. 2-0 the count. Kobayashi not taking off, and the pitch fouled back by Bryant, now a 2-1 count. The Rafters bottom four in the batting order. Actually, we'll extend that to bottom five. The bottom five in the batting order have combined to go 0-for-14 this game, and this one laced out towards left center field, and that will turn that stat around. At least a double as Bryant is into second, and he will stay put there. An RBI double is at that, as Kobayashi will easily score from first base. Peyton Bryant, a big-time hit for the Rafters, absolutely laced up that baseball, and now a six-run game in the top of the ninth inning. It's 9-3, Dock Spiders, and brings up Lachlan Maud to the plate with a runner on second and one out in the top of the ninth. Maud, the right-handed hitting catcher, it's a righty-righty matchup between him and Moses. Moses looking home, and Maud wiggling the bat around above his shoulder. Moses looks back to second where Bryant stands, now fires home, and the fastball in there for strike number one. 0-1 the count. Maud 0-3 on the game. He got double last time up on a line out straight back to the mound. Tough play there for him because he hit the ball well. 0-1 the count, and on the lower part of the zone, it's called for strike number two. 87 miles an hour on that fastball, and one of the faster pitches we've seen today from Moses. Hovers around mid-80s. Usually see 85, 86 on the fastball. 0-2 the count, and the pitch coming from Moses. It is in there, called strike three, and Maud just stared at it, as that's the second strikeout of the game for Samuel Moses, and it brings up Mike Monum to the plate, representing the final out for the Rafters. Two away in the top of the ninth. It's 9-3, Dock Spiders. Runner on second for the Rafters, and Monum, the right-handed hitting DH. It's a righty-righty matchup between him and Moses. Moses on the mound, fires it home, and that one inside for ball number one, a 1-0 count. And Monum 0-3 on the game. He grounded out his last time up, struck out the first two times. So trying to get on base any way possible to keep the game going. 1-0 count. It's a swing and a miss for strike number one. 1-1 the count, and Monum trying his best to get back on track, but it has been a real downward spiral for him this season. 1-1 the count coming home. It's outside for ball number two, a 2-1 count, and Monum at the very least trying to end the season on a high note. Getting plenty of opportunities here with the Rafters. An outfielder who is DHing today. 2-1 count. Coming home, it is just outside for ball three. 3-1 the count. And Kobayashi drew a walk earlier in the inning. Peyton Bryant then doubled to send him home. And Monum trying to be the second walk of the game from Samuel Moses. But he'll have to fight with the 3-1 count. And it's outside for ball number four. And so Monum will head on down to first base. Or maybe not. Okay, yes, he will. That was ball number four. Monum, I think, thought it was ball three. But now he heads down to first. And with that, there are runners on first and second with two outs in the top of the ninth. Brings up Christian Bermudez to the plate. 9-3, the Dock Spiders lead, and Rafters still down to their last out. Moses trying to finish it off. First pitch to Bermudez in there for strike number one. 0-1 the count. And Bermudez 0-2 on the game, but he did draw a walk his last time up back in the eighth inning. The Rafters have walked four times between the eighth and the ninth innings. 0-1 count. Both runners going. It misses low and not picked up by Jonathan Fitz. And so a double steal there. And now a 1-1 count to Christian Bermudez. Runners on second and third for the Rafters. Officially, that's going to go as defensive indifference despite them taking off, knowing that the catcher could throw as the 1-1 count misses outside for ball number two, a 2-1 count. So no stolen base there. Both of them going on defensive indifference and a 2-1 count to Bermudez. Bermuda is going to be patient as Moses brings the pitch home, but misses outside again. 3-1 the count, and Moses struggling with location here. He's trying to avoid his third walk of the inning. One of those walks, though, to Kobayashi. He had to throw strikes on, five of them, but Kobayashi fouled him off. 3-1 count, grounded to the right side of the infield, and sneaks on past the glove of the diving second baseman into right. And here comes one run, here comes another, and the tag, it is in time somehow. Monum had got in there plenty of time, but game is called over as the umpire wants to get out of here. And so with that, it finishes up this game, a 9-5 final score, 9-4 final score on that one as the Rafters, I'll turn down that crowd mic here, is The Rafters have Monum thrown out at the plate on one that he had slid in there for, but not able to get the call. And so with that, it ends the game with the RBI single from Christian Bermudez. Final score, it is 9-4, and with that, the postgame show comes up next. Unfortunately, the Rafters not able to finish this one out, and it would have taken a lot more than that last call to go their way, as they lost by 5 here, and you can't blame everything on one play at the end of the game. The offense just stifled by Jordan Tuohy and Colton Angel throughout the entire night, and they're going to hope to get back on the right track, but it's not going to be any easier tomorrow. We'll talk about it all coming up on the postgame show. We'll recap how this game went, take a look back at the stats and the numbers, and then take a look ahead to tomorrow night's game, all on the Rafters postgame show. That comes up next here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money. Or your TV. I can't be scared away or negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
It's back. Because of the tremendous response last year, the studios of WFHR and WIRI will be having an open house on Wednesday, August 20th from 12 to 6 p.m. Join the crew for food trucks, games, and a staff dessert contest. Kids can try their hand at being a radio announcer. Some will even be played on the air. Local nonprofits will be on hand, along with special live broadcasts on both stations. Join us right here, 1690 2nd Avenue South, for our open house on August 20th from 12 to 6.
Now, let's get back to exciting Rafters baseball here on WFHR.
Rafters postgame show coming your way here on WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, and not a good news Thursday night as they fall 9-4 against the Fond du Lac Dock Spiders. Let's take a look back at how it all happened. And for the Dock Spiders, the scoring started early. They scored 2 runs in the first inning on a 2-RBI double from Jonathan Fitz off Rafters starter Justin Battle. Second inning comes around, and they have an RBI double from Tommy Guggins. That made it 3-0. Then it became 4-0 in the third inning as they had yet another run come across on an RBI single from James Bornick. So that made it the 4-0 game. Justin Battle only able to go those 3 innings before he was pulled out of the game with 61 pitches. He had thrown 63 pitches his last game, but he had gone 6 innings and allowed just 1 run. So a big difference for him, not able to have the game he was hoping for. The Rafters, though, they finally got the offense moving in the top of the fourth. An RBI triple from Kareem Arusovic, RBI double from Jake Beauchesne. That made it a 4-2 ball game, and it would remain 4-2 all the way up until the bottom of the seventh, as Easton Zempel had 3 shutout innings, but Jackson Phillip, not the game that he was hoping for. In the seventh inning, he allowed 3 runs. It was an RBI single from Camden Kunkey, RBI fielder's choice from James Bornick, and another RBI fielder's choice from Jaron Cotton. That made it then a 7-2 ball game, and the Rafters feeling out of it. It was even more so in the Dock Spiders' direction in the bottom of the eighth. They scored another 2 runs, RBI triple from James Hankerson Jr., and an RBI ground out from Jonathan Fitz. That made it 9-2. The Rafters in the top of the ninth, they were able to draw across 1 run on Peyton Bryant's RBI double, another run on the RBI single from Christian Bermudez, and then Mike Monum, by technicality, thrown out at home as that ended the game. And an RBI single from Christian Bermudez is all that he would get, not the 2 RBIs. And so final score was 9-4. The Rafters unable to get the win. And let's take a look back at the stats and numbers, as Kareem Arusovic really showed off. 3-for-4 from the plate. He had a triple, a run, and an RBI scored. Along with that, nobody else had a multi-hit game, although River Lindsay reached multiple times as he went 1-for-3 with a run and a walk. And along with that, Christian Bermudez went 1-for-3 with a walk. He reached multiple times as well, although Hiroto Kobayashi's did not reach multiple times today. He just drew the one walk, and so his 7 straight games reaching multiple times ends today. Taking a look at the pitching side, Justin Battle, 3 innings. He allowed 4 runs. All 4 were earned while striking out 2. He allowed 6 hits and 3 walks. Easton Zempel in 3 shutout innings. He did not walk a batter, and that has continued to be his best asset as he allowed just the 3 hits and had 2 strikeouts. Jackson Phillip, 2 innings pitched. He allowed 5 runs. All 5 were earned. On 6 hits and 1 walk, he did not strike out a batter. Still looking for his first strikeout as a Rafter. Taking a look ahead to next game, the Rafters have just 2 more games left this season, both of them coming in Wausau as a 2-game series to close out the year. Mentioned it earlier, Trevor Moik is on the mound for the Rafters tomorrow, as Grant Parson is going to be on the mound for the Woodchucks. He's got a 1.88 ERA and a 3-0 record. He has been great this year, and he's hoping to keep it rolling for the Woodchucks, as first pitch comes at 6:35 p.m. That means pregame show comes your way at 6:20. However, that is all for tonight's broadcast. So I hope to have you tuning in for the game at Wausau tomorrow, unless, of course, you're there. Maybe even if you are there, put in some earbuds and tune in to WFHR online or with a radio if you happen to bring it to the stadium, although I'm not sure you'd be allowed to bring one in. I don't know the rules there. But regardless, hope to have you tuned into the game tomorrow. But that is going to do it for our broadcast tonight. So a big thank you to Fond du Lac for hosting us and the hospitality, as always, Parker Poril, for being a great host here and a great friend to get to talk to throughout the season. They do a really good job here in Fond du Lac and such a great place to be in. Another shout-out has to go to our folks up at WFHR for hosting us on the radio side, as always. Always great to have a place to broadcast these games and for supporting Rafters baseball throughout the years. One more shout out has to go to our coaching staff of the Rafters for being open to talk to, and to River Lindsay, our pregame guest of the show from today's game. But that's just going to about do it for tonight from Fond du Lac. So one final time, the Rafters 4, the Dock Spiders 9, the final score here on WFHR. From myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you, and have a great rest of your night.
It's the political spectrum. This is the crisis calls for people to refocus and think about the economy that we want to build and the policies that it's going to take to get us there. So, and I do think that, you know, for us right now, states are, you know, we've already got, you know, piles of model policies from states around the country that have achieved, you know, much better outcomes for workers. There are long lists of states that have room to adopt some of those policies and at the very least shore up rights for workers right now that are in crisis because of the federal attacks.
Because I get accused quite often of all I focus on are the attacks that are coming. And look, it's all about self-preservation in this moment. Obviously, you know, the push for right to work laws, the push to end prevailing wages, and you go down the list, you know, the child labor law assaults, the you know, ending a lot of the protections in the world of safety. I focus on those a lot, but not as much as on what should be done to fix those things. And this is where Democrats, I think, need to take a moment and go, we should, even if it's not going to pass, even if it's just messaging, saying this is the world that we want to move to. Here's some positive. Do you see any states where there are those kind of pieces of legislation out there where people are going, hey, this is the world we want to be working towards? Yeah, we're getting killed here, but this is what we should be aspiring to. Do you see any of that?
Yeah, I think we see it everywhere. And let me toss out maybe a couple concrete examples to give it. Well, let me start with right to work, actually, since you raised that issue. You know, we've really had a multi-year arc, frankly, of really positive state action on either resisting right to work attacks. No new right to work laws have been passed anywhere in the country for several years running now. And that's because voters have been clear that it is hugely unpopular. So just this past year, once again, New Hampshire rejected a right to work proposal. Maine rejected a right to work proposal. Colorado is continuing to attempt to finally overturn their de facto right to work policy that was passed by their state legislature. It only didn't get enacted because their governor vetoed it. Michigan, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners already know, reversed its right to work law a couple years ago. So, you know, we're moving in a very clear direction, I would say, in terms of state policy on right to work. And it's away from more states enacting that versus the opposite, despite the attacks, right? I mean, the National Right to Work Foundation is never going to stop pushing that legislation, and the right wing, you know, employer interests that fund that attack is never going to stop. But in terms of actual state policymaking, people are refusing. And you could see, you know, Missouri was maybe the start of that, right? Their state legislature passed that. Voters took it to the ballot and said, no, we don't want to be a right to work state, right? And since then, we have not seen one new right to work law enacted anywhere.
No, and that's fabulous.
Just want to kind of lay that out, that's the direction to me that appears we're going on the state level.
And that's great. And that's fabulous. But understand, you know, 90% of the workforce in this country is a member of a union. And for them, they don't know what that means. What they're looking for are tangible things and how that's going to help them. Now, we talk about why union membership is so important and why having rights on the job and the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and a contract to end at-will employment and all that stuff, why that's important. But I think most voters have kind of given up on the hope for that and just like, hey, how are you going to put food on the table today? How are we going to actually lower costs or raise my wages in other ways? For me, I want to see more specific, you know, raise the minimum wage, start taxing billionaires like we should be. There should some other things. Do you have some of those?
Yeah, let me run through some of those. And anybody who's interested in the minimum wage question, we've got a page on our website that tracks that very state by state and locality by locality. So if you type in epi.org minimum wage, you can go to a map and know exactly where we're at. So where we are is that more than half the states in the country have raised their minimum wages above the federal floor. And just this past year, Rhode Island just passed legislation to phase in $17 an hour by 2027. Virginia also passed very similar legislation. Again, the hang up there was that their current governor vetoed it, but that is an issue that people are going to bring back again. And they've got a governor's race in process right now that could change the outcome the next time. We've got places like Maine, where this past year, this is an issue that advocates had been working on and that farm worker organizations had been working on for years. The legislature finally closed one of the loopholes that is still with us from the racist passage of our initial Fair Labor Standards Act that excluded farm workers and excluded domestic workers, who at the time were largely Black people in the South who were not covered by our wage laws. Maine took the step that now many other states around the country have begun to do, which is covering farm workers with their state minimum wage, since it's not covered at the federal level. We've got a growing number of states. Georgia is the first the latest one that just this past year are taking steps to close another big loophole in our wage laws, which is the sub-minimum wage that some employers are allowed to pay to workers with disabilities. A lot of states, because of advocacy from workers with disabilities and their families, have recognized this is exploitative and there's no need for it, right? If somebody is putting in the same hours as somebody else on the same job, there is no reason they should be paid less than somebody who's doing exactly the same work just because of their disability status. So lots of states are closing that loophole. Like I said, Georgia was the latest one. We've got things like that happening all over. Paid leave would be another spot to look at.
All things that we could aspire to be moving towards. And I wish there were a political party that spent more time talking about that. I wish there was more attention paid to the things that we should be working towards, as opposed to just, now look, we got to fight the fights, but just focusing on that. Just my thoughts. Last question I've got for you. If folks want more information on these kind of topics, where's the best place to go?
epi.org. So there's anything I mentioned, plus lots more being documented there. And all the recommendations that we're starting to compile, and links to examples of great models of state policy that are already in place that others can basically borrow from and replicate. That series, we're calling it Holding the Line. We just issued the first 4 installments this week, and we're going to keep adding to that with other issues as the year goes on.
There you go. Jennifer, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great stuff. Thanks so much.
Yeah, take care.
Jennifer Shearer, Deputy Director at the Economic Analysis and Research Network there at the Economic Policy Institute. Just go to epi.org if you want to check out more of what they do. Want to hear your thoughts. You agree with me? Should we be aspiring to more? And should there be that political party that maybe brings it to us? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy, warm and muggy tonight. Slight storm chance. Lows in the upper 60s. Hazy, hot and humid tomorrow. High in the low 90s. Heat index approaching 100. Storm chances return for the upcoming weekend. Not as warm, but humid. Right now it's 80.
It's back. Because of the tremendous response last year, the studios of WFHR and WIRI will be having an open house on Wednesday, August 20th from 12 to 6 p.m. Join the crew for food trucks, games, and a staff dessert contest. Kids can try their hand at being a radio announcer. Some will even be played on the air. Local nonprofits will be on hand, along with special live broadcasts on both stations. Join us right here, 1690 2nd Avenue South, for our open house on August 20th from 12 to 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, Politico had a really interesting article that I think my red hat folks might want to know, because Trump's been running around saying we brought in billions, $150 billion plus dollars in tariff tax money that are supposedly going into the coffers, but Politico's reporting might have to pay it all back. Evidently, there are a number of companies and states that are challenging the way Trump went about this, the emergency law that he's using, that it could go to the Supreme Court, and they could have to pay it all back. So all of the prosperity, well, could evaporate, much like all of the promises of this administration and this trade war. Look, I'm not an anti-tariff guy, but this trade war is kind of stupid. And the question, I guess, is his trade war destroying jobs here at home? Because the latest jobs number, not sure if you noticed, not really encouraging for Dear Leader's record, which may explain why he fired the messenger. And here to help us work through those questions and more, I've asked Natalie Baker to come talk with us. She's the Director of Economic Analysis there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, americanprogress.org. Natalie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be with you.
So there's the question. You know, since Liberation Day, how are we doing?
Yeah, so for those who missed it, Friday last week was a real warning sign on the economy. So we had some data that came out, and it was clear evidence of a slowdown, and it's a warning of things to come. So just to throw a few numbers at you. So for the last 3 months, the average jobs growth was 35,000 per month. That is really quite low compared to what we've seen in the past. So if we think about that number, 35,000 over the last 3 months compared to the last year in 2024, that average was 168,000. So this is really a worrying sign for jobs and the economy more broadly.
Lies. We've been 500,000 jobs a month. That's what we've been creating. You just have those Joe Biden rigged numbers.
So exactly to your point.
You don't know where to go with that, do you?
Exactly to your point earlier, this was a classic case of shooting the messenger. So the BLS, that's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, They are, you know, high quality institution that produce great data. It's produced by nonpartisan independent economists. They've been doing this work for decades. And instead, when they produced Friday's report, as they have done for decades, this was a shooting the messenger case, and Trump said, "You're fired."
But should we be surprised? I mean, we're moving into this world of if dear leader doesn't like it, you know, someone's got to pay. And so I know a lot of people were surprised, and I've had friends who, "Can you believe it?" I go, "Yeah, I can believe it." And I expect it to get much worse.
Yeah, and I think that's why this jobs report, you know, it's a warning sign on the numbers side of things and what this means for the economy. But it's also a warning sign in terms of what's happening in the future and the future of these institutions. And one point I just really want to make here, Rick, is, you know, if we think about the effect of economic uncertainty, this is just yet another case that we've seen where these policies are causing harm to consumers, to families, to businesses, and that uncertainty is really difficult to unwind.
So walk me through some of these policies, because again, my red hat crowd, they're very happy to tell me, well, this is the Biden economy. And Trump hasn't, because Trump told us everything bad is Joe Biden's fault, everything good is his fault. So can you make that argument that, you know, this is the residual of all the horrible things that Biden did?
Yeah, so this is where I'd go back to what the data says on this. So if we look at where we were at the end of 2024, in terms of the economy, you know, we had decent growth. We had growth that exceeded projections over the course of 24. We had a strong labor market. We had good jobs numbers, and inflation was coming down. So if I compare that to where we are today, you know, all in the space of the last week, we had a weak report on GDP. So that's weak growth numbers. When we look at what's happened in the first half of this year, you've got inflationary pressures coming about through the inflation reports that we're seeing, and particularly on goods that we might expect to be imported goods. So we're seeing some impact likely from the effects of tariffs that are coming through. So you add those things together, the jobs numbers, the GDP numbers, and the growth, the overall health of the economy, and coupled with the inflation, you know, it starts to paint a pretty worrying picture.
So how much of this lands back into Trump's lap? Because I have friends who also were saying, well, that's just cyclical. This is just the economy. The president really doesn't do anything to create jobs. He's not really the guy who runs the economy. And my response to that usually is, look, I played sports for a lot of years. No coach ever won a game, but there were a lot of coaches who lost games by doing dumb things. That's how I see this, but I'm curious your thoughts.
That's exactly right, Rick. So, you know, when we compare 2024, a really strong economy overall, a really resilient economy that we saw through the end of 2024, and then several deliberate policy choices by the current administration, all of which have pointed in the wrong direction in terms of economic performance. So I mentioned tariffs before, that's one of them. And it's the on-again, off-again uncertainty that creates that's particularly problematic. You know, it's harder for businesses to plan their inventory. How do they set prices in the context of those prices changing? So all of that contributes to this uncertainty. The other point I just want to touch on there as well is if we think about this recent budget bill that was passed, so this one, you know, big, beautiful bill, if we think about the effects that's going to have on the future, you know, the sort of Congressional Budget Office is sort of the independent nonpartisan assessor of these things, and the picture is not good there either. So you've got multiple policy settings, this sense of economic uncertainty and chaos, all of which is feeding through in sentiment, consumer sentiment, how people feel about the economy. It's just that now we're also starting to see it in the hard data.
So if I'm hearing you right, and maybe I'm just putting words in your mouth, am I hearing that things are going to get worse?
That's exactly right. So when we looked at what the projections from economists were about how the economy was going to go in 2025, things were looking good. Those forecasts have often been revised down, you know, over the course of this year, whether it's sort of investment bankers or economists, other folks who really look at the numbers on this. We've seen consistently that those projections have been revised down. And a lot of that, again, is hinging on this uncertainty around tariffs and the global impacts that those will have.
Because we really don't know what we hear a lot of stories. And the one thing I give Trump credit for, he really knows how to ramp something up. He knows how to take advantage of it from the PR standpoint. He knows how to get attention. Details, I don't think that's his suit, but as long as he gets a headline, I don't think he cares. This seems a lot of that, because I keep hearing people go, well, this isn't what we voted for. I'm coming back to, no, I'm going to call, nonsense. This is kind of what everybody who voted for him voted for.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there's always big flashy statements. But what we care about is the fact and how that's affecting people on the ground. And so, sometimes we can talk about big numbers in the economy and it's hard to parse out what that actually means. But if we think about what's happening to everyday people, less jobs in the economy, that's going to flow through. We're seeing spikes in youth unemployment. It's harder to get a job these days. And that tight labor market, trying to get that first foothold is really difficult. So if we think about how some of these big choices are actually affecting people on the ground, it's pretty concerning.
Now, the jobs numbers you talked about, is it shocking that we would have such poor job numbers, given the fact that they're pulling a bunch of federal employment, they're pulling a bunch of money back? I talked to my building trades friends who were saying, they're gutting some of the investments that Biden was making into infrastructure. Is any of this surprising? Because, I've had people say, well, there's partisanship in these places and, they just don't like Trump. I'm going, no, there are actual hardcore policy choices that they've made that have pulled back government funding, which is a huge driver of our economy, which I think created this. Clearly, you're the economist person here. Am I anywhere near the right spot?
That's exactly right. So what we saw in this jobs report, in addition to the sort of soft headline number, you see specific industries have been impacted. So, since April, when the Trump tariff sort of Liberation Day announcement happened, there's been 37,000 jobs lost in manufacturing alone. And also big job losses in federal employment. So that's no surprise. And what often happens with these things is you see early signs in the sentiment data, surveys of businesses as they're making those decisions, consumers as they're deciding how to spend for the year. But now it's flowed through to the hard data as well. And so I think it's likely, this is just one set of data. We'll have to wait for more, but it's likely that we'll see a really softening economy in the second half of the year.
Yeah, I'm feeling really liberated. I know a lot of people are liberated out of their jobs, which I don't feel is overly liberating because, as you pointed out, the one big nightmare bill that they passed has a lot of cuts to the social safety net that would help folks who are losing their jobs. So it seems like they've put us in a direction, and maybe you can talk to this a little bit, that they're moving us in a direction to create even more desperation out of the desperation that they're causing.
That's exactly right. So if we look at the one big beautiful bill, you've got major tax cuts that disproportionately go to the wealthy, and you've got major cuts to really critical social programs, social services, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's food assistance and the SNAP program, which disproportionately benefit low-income folks who need a hand up. So this is a really regressive bill when we think about it in totality, and it has little to no economic gain, according to the independent analyses.
But we're told, I'm sorry, Natalie, we're told that with those tax cuts, that's going to be what's going to jumpstart our economy. This time it's going to work. They promised.
Yeah. And again, I go back to the data there. So, we look at what the independent Congressional Budget Office says on expectations for growth, and it's very weak. So we think about corporate tax cuts or individual personal tax cuts for very wealthy folks. It's not a good picture in the way that this is structured in that bill.
Is there a way to turn this around? Is there a way Trump can salvage this? Now, I think he's so into this tariff game that I don't think is going to work. And I said it from the beginning. I think what he's going to do ultimately is screw up the idea of using tariffs, which I am in favor of strategically as part of an overall strategy, not as a bludgeon or the only tool in the box. But I fear that he's going to do this so badly that we never use that tool again. I'm curious, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just go back to what's happening in terms of business and consumer decision-making and how hard it is to plan when you've got this on-again, off-again tariff situation. So in those situations, I mean, it's no wonder that you're starting to see the kinds of data that we are, where businesses aren't able to invest. They're not making decisions to support, physical investments or hiring workers. So, you know, it's a pretty natural consequence. It's what a lot of economists expected. We're now just seeing that come through.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, they brought in $150 billion. They may have to pay it back, but they brought in a whole bunch of money. This should be a good thing for the economy. No, we're shaking down the UK. Best deal ever. We're shaking down India. We're shaking down the globe. This should be great. No?
I think the sad reality is that in the long term, it's Americans who will pay the cost of these tariffs in the way that they're designed, because they're blunt, they're broad, and they're constantly changing. So, it's the sad of it. But unfortunately, in the long run, what we probably will see is price increases that are disproportionately borne by Americans right here at home. So
last question I've got for you then, because, you know, I don't think most people have seen the effects yet of, well, the big, beautiful bill or any of the Trump policies yet. I don't think they've made their way through. What are we looking for in the fall and into the Christmas season? Is that when we're going to see things start to hit? I'm curious when you think public sentiment might turn in a direction that would be proportionate.
So I think, you know, different parts of the bill will come in at different times. So I don't want to sort of make a blanket statement on that. What I will say, the thing that I'm most worried about with this bill is that it could push up borrowing costs for you know, everyday households. So if you're a borrower, whether it's a car loan, it's a mortgage, a home loan, or you're a small business owner and you want to take out a loan, there is a risk that this bill, you know, in increasing the government debt, could actually increase your cost of borrowing. And that's what I'm really worried about in the context of what's going on, and sometimes gets missed in all of the kind of hurrah about this bill.
No, I mean, because, you know, we know Trump has a history of bankrupting companies. I know a lot of people who wanted the federal government to run like a business. My fear is just what you said, plus all of the other stuff that's piled on top of that. The goal here isn't really about raising tariffs to bring money in. It's all about bankrupting. And then, you know, kind of, I don't know what after that, but bankrupting companies seem to work for him before. So kind of got that feel.
Yeah. And if we look at the jobs numbers from Friday, and you've got a fall in manufacturing employment, it's pretty clear evidence that the so-called, you know, tariffs, boosting this argument that tariffs will as they're defined, both support international security and they'll, you know, support local businesses. We are not seeing that yeah happen. Well, so
again, another con job, another sales job, just what we expected. But Natalie, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your expertise. I look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate your time, too.
Thanks so much. Natalie Baker, Director of Economic Analysis there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Are you seeing the trickle-down effect? Is the economy getting better for you, worse? Want to hear it? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that one of the heroines of the U.S. labor movement, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, was born in Concord, New Hampshire. Elizabeth learned her progressive politics at a young age. Her father was a socialist and her mother a feminist. Elizabeth was kicked out of high school for speaking out in favor of socialism. This did not slow her down. She kept speaking and her reputation grew. She became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She traveled the country organizing and speaking to workers. From the Minnesota Iron Range to the textile mills of Lawrence, Massachusetts, Elizabeth was on the front lines of the labor struggle. She was arrested for her activity 10 times, but was never sentenced. During World War I, Flynn was arrested and stood trial for speaking out against the war. The experience led her to become one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization dedicated to protecting freedom of speech. In the 1930s, Flynn became a member of the U.S. Communist Party, writing a regular column for the Daily Worker. But despite her personal political ideas, she supported Democratic Party President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944. During the 1950s, she was caught up in the anti-communist hysteria led by Senator Joe McCarthy. She went to prison for 2 years for allegedly violating the Smith Act, a law against overthrowing the government. She died while on a visit to Russia in 1964. More than 20,000 people attended her funeral there. A monument to Flynn stands at the Forest Home Cemetery just outside of Chicago, where she is buried alongside the graves of Eugene Dennis, Big Bill Haywood, and the Haymarket Martyrs. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, interesting situation out in Utah. The Salt Lake Tribune reported that last year, an 18-year-old from Utah was staring at the potential of years in prison, accused of having sex with a 13-year-old. Plea bargain negotiations were evidently at an impasse, according to the reporting. And then the Utah State Legislature, based on the initial suggestion from Senate President J. Stuart Adams, they changed the law. 2 months later, prosecutors offered the 18-year-old, who is not surprisingly related to Adams, offered him a plea deal. And that plea deal, no jail time, reduced charges, and he's not going to have to register as a sex offender. It's one of those things where, you know, in Republican circles, it's good to know people, especially Republicans who are willing to let you out, let you go. Get out of basically what is in most states rape free card. There you go. Also, more fun with sex with Republicans. Republican Representative Derek Van Orden, he's a Republican in Wisconsin, evidently posted on the Twitters, posted a naked man wearing a ski mask, carrying a sex toy tied to a walking stick, and then said that it was another representative from Wisconsin, Mark Pocan. And it wasn't. But you know, this is what we're getting out of our representatives on the Republican side. Pocan did swing back, accused Van Orden of alcoholism, asked him if he was drunk again. And, you know, who knows? But again, we have our Republican friends who just, it is what it is. Also, Miley Biggs, she's the daughter of Republican Representative Andy Biggs, Freedom Caucus guy, or out, in, out. Anyway, she evidently is running for a seat in the Arizona Senate. Interestingly enough, she mentioned on a podcast last year, women shouldn't hold office. She doesn't think that women should run for office. She wouldn't vote, probably wouldn't vote for a woman running for office, but she's running for office. And it really does show the hypocrisy of those folks. Just kind of is what it is. And finally today, alligator Alcatraz. The story broke that NBC broke a story in Miami that it's basically a hellhole, which I know my red hat friends would be tickled by. They're the worst of the worst. But evidently no sunlight, backed up toilets, no access to showers, basic inhumanity. And in our name. And this is the place that Christy Noem, she says that it's the model for ICE state-run detention centers, Alligator Alcatraz, which they've made up names. They've made up signs that they've put outside because they're proud of that. It's their branding. And it's what you expect from this administration. And now we find out, not just Alligator Alcatraz, but there's going to be a Speedway Slammer in Indianapolis. or Indiana somewhere, not maybe not Indianapolis, but she says we're going to go get the worst of the worst for this one. It's going to attain the worst of the worst. So what she means is, you know, the people who clean the hotels and do the construction work and, you know, cut the grass and do the work that most Americans don't want to do. The worst of the worst. Which leads me to Kathy Hochul. Yesterday, you talked a little bit about Kathy Hochul and the idea that, we need to fight. Started today off with her quote that we're at war. Agree. This is where she, again, not a huge, huge fan, but she's not wrong in saying that, up until now, Democrats have treated our political system like it's still governing by norms, guided by limits, rooted in fairness. She goes on to say rules were meant to be followed. It hurts to say it, but that era has come to an end. And it made me, when I saw that, it made me think, am I the only one who remembers the whole when they go low, we go high nonsense? And am I the only one who remembers all of the attacks I got from people when I said, no, when they go low, you smash their face into the ground. It's, you know, what I learned playing football as a kid. When they go after your knees, when they go to chop off your knees, defend yourself. Hands to the back of the head and into the dirt. That's what you do. And once you do it once, maybe they don't do it again. And if they do it again, with the hands and then a knee. This idea that, you know, we're above the fray. And I remember the argument at the time of people going, well, you know, we're better than that. No, you shouldn't be, because you're going to lose. And understand, Democrats have been losing for a very long time. And it's what I've been saying of how they lost the working class. They haven't been fighting. Or the appearance is they haven't been fighting. They've been playing by Marcus of Queensbury rules, which, sorry to say, long gone. Maybe this redistricting thing, I don't know. Maybe this is that moment where Democrats have that oh, yeah, this is it. We're kind of close to the end of the road. But I guess better late than never. So as New York, California, Illinois, other places are going, hey, you know, we're gonna think about doing this too. While personally I'm not in favor of the country going in this direction, if they go low, you gotta meet them where they are. And as much as I hate the idea of doing this, maybe California, New York, Illinois, maybe those states. Maybe you're going to have to go that route until things get so bad that we're at each other again. And not in the way that we've been recently. We're literally tearing the country apart. And Republicans don't have a problem with this. They know what they're doing. The difference this time is they're planning on Democrats caving. They're planning on Dick Cheney, back when he was vice president, was asked about, if Democrats would surrender to what they were doing. And he's like, yeah, it's what they do. It was like, as a matter of course. Yeah, they're going to complain a little bit, but yeah, they're going to give in because it's what they do. And to be honest, it's what Democrats have done for quite some time. All in the name of saving the institution. It's like the analogy I give. You know, Republicans come to the Democrat and go, we want to chop off both your legs. Democrats will go, can you just take one? And they go, okay, and they take that one. Then they come back the next day and go, you know what? We really want both. Democrats, how about just up to the knee? Oh, okay. And we slowly, death of a thousand cuts, we've gotten where we are. This is the take your stand. This is the stand your ground moment. Question is, will Democrats do it? And is the game already so badly rigged that it really doesn't matter? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? Is this finally it? Will we see Democrats with a backbone and a spine? We'll see. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Firefighters are trying to gain control of multiple wildfires in California. The most significant is the Gifford Fire, burning in the central part of the state. At least four people have been injured, and more than 99,000 acres have burned across two counties. CBS's Jason Allen.
We've been watching as firefighters and sheriff deputies have been driving up and down the roads here. They have been walking up to the front doors, telling owners that they are now in a mandatory evacuation zone. If they leave, they may not be able to get back in. If they stay, there may not be anybody to come help them.
In northeastern Pennsylvania, some 50 miles north of Scranton, police say a woman was shot and killed by a neighbor as she walked to her car. CBS's Wendy Gillette also reporting.
Two state troopers, Joseph Parachinsky and William Jenkins, were airlifted to a local hospital after they were both shot. Police say they